And what I'm going to do is give an overview and make jump through some of these diseases. This is a two-part segment that I put together on infectious diseases of reptiles. And I've been working on diseases of reptiles since I arrived at the University of Florida in 1977. And because of the environment there and the number of people in the state of Florida that keep reptiles, I've been able to get involved with a lot of different projects, both as a clinician and as a researcher. And some of these clinical problems have gone on to become research projects. The big problem always is getting money to support the projects and to do the research that's needed. Most of our biggest projects have been with sea turtles and desert tortoises and gopher tortoises, just because of the importance of those animals, and there's a lot of money tied, enough money tied to them for us to do some decent research. Plug in for a book I did a few years ago in 07. It still, I think, has the best information on infectious diseases and pathology related to infectious diseases of reptiles. This is from CRC Press and has about 1,200 figures and plates in it, and they've done really, really well. And that's where I started out on the left. It's my first water snake I ever caught. And then this is out going to work on a camel herd, a water moccasin on the side of the road. And so I was in heaven when I went to Florida. Still am. And this is our college. We have a new clinic, have a very, very modernized clinic. And within this, we have a zoological medicine service that I was and still continue, even though I retired last year, I'm still a part of that service. And we work with a lot of different things. We've done a lot of work with fruit bats, pteropus, and other genera of fruit bats. You see, this is a bottle of Bacardi, and that's the icon symbol on the bottle. It's a symbol of good luck for the family. And so one of the grandsons or sons of the original Bacardi has moved to Gainesville and built a bat conservation facility. And so they have about 200 to 300 pteropus, and we do the veterinary work on them, and really very neat animals. Then we had a very large elephant herd in Florida for about 4 years. A fellow who put this together was Arthur Jones, who's now passed away 2 years ago. But Arthur Jones had a very large crocodile collection and a very big snake collection at this same operation. And he had one of the biggest saltwater crocs in the world. And eventually all the crocs went to St. Augustine Alligator Farm, and the elephants would disperse to sold off to various circuses and zoos. But for 4 years, we did a lot of elephant work, and that was a pretty unique experience. But my love has been reptiles, and I've worked with them for a good part of my life, either keeping them as a kid, and I continue to keep them now into retirement to try and breed and break even. That's all I hope for. My philosophy on buying animals is buy high, sell low, because that's pretty much what's happened with me. So I'm not into color morph ball pythons. I'm into snakes that very few other people care about. But in our clinic, we get a lot of fair number of reptiles, 25% of the caseload of reptiles. Iguanas were popular in the 90s. They see them still, but not at the level of popularity. And that's a young Galapagos tortoise that's now 20-some-odd years old and weighs 250, 300 pounds. And so some of these animals come back, especially the Colonians, over a long period of time. And work with reptiles in the field, in captivity. Up above is one of our residents working on an alligator at St. Augustine Alligator Farm. I think it was a Galapagos tortoise. That's a very sophisticated positioning device that we use for positioning their limbs for taking radiographs. Very expensive and lasts forever. And then down below, sea turtles. We've been working with sea turtles for many years, particularly on a cutaneous tumor on their skin, but also internally, called fibropapilloma. And that's been a very interesting disease in these animals. It's not only in green turtles, but it's in loggerheads and hawksbills and ridleys. And so it's a very intriguing worldwide disease in these animals. And so get an idea of the number of reptiles. And actually this has changed with the new taxonomy, which is sequencing. And so today there's probably about 8,500 species of reptiles. And of those, the actual number in the pet trade is still pretty small. We see the totality of reptiles and amphibians that come into the pet trade. It's relatively small. And of those, the ones that really are good pets are even smaller than that. And the vast majority of these animals we know very little about. And here's the major groupings of the reptiles. And today we see that the birds are actually considered by most probably taxonomists as part of the reptilia. And so we have the avian and the non-avian reptiles. Avian reptiles are the birds. Non-avian reptiles are all these other groups. The Chelonia, the Crocodilia, Rhynchocephala, the two species of Tuatera, and the Squamata, the largest of the present-day reptiles, with lizards being the largest single group. And of these lizards, the vast majority as adults are under 30 grams in body weight. And many of those we really don't see. And these, the evolution of reptiles has changed somewhat now a little bit. There's some different drawings that could come about, especially between the birds and some of the other reptiles. But for the most part, they've come off some stock that gave rise to two different lineages. You have the crocodilian and then aves, the birds, probably coming out of some kind of dinosaur crocodilian lineage, and lizards and snakes along another line. And the Chelonians, some feel the Chelonians are related to the crocodilians, but that isn't hard and fast right now. But the Chelonians go back the oldest in time, maybe 120 million years or so, that the fossil record can go back with them. And the lizards and snakes, with the snakes being the most modern of the present-day reptiles. And so here, I mean, there's lots of papers that have come out looking, and these are on phylogenomics and the non-avian reptiles and the structure of the ancestral amniote genome. And so all of this is a consequence of sequencing. And the sequencing of DNA has revolutionized the field of taxonomy. And when we have these animals that are called sibling species, these are species that previously in taxonomically you couldn't distinguish them. They look to be the same. And then when you work on them by sequencing, you find out they're very different. So sequencing has changed really the way that we look and the way we categorize these animals and name them. And so here's a list of viruses. These are families of viruses. Now viruses are just like in vertebrates and invertebrates. The families end in DAE, subfamilies are NAE. So we have the Bicorna viridae, Calcilla viridae, Toga viridae, Herpes viridae. Herpes viridae is the family that has the herpes viruses. Okay, so, and the major genus is herpes virus. But there are others. And so adenoviridae, pox viridae, pox viruses, and so on. So we have all of these are major families of viruses that we see in mammals and birds, and we also see them in reptiles. And reptiles appear now. There are some very unique viruses that are being described now in reptiles that will probably wind up in groups of their own that are really distinct. But there are more similarities than being totally and completely distinct when we look at reptiles, birds, and mammals. And reptiles and birds are more closely related. And reptiles and mammals are more closely related than mammals and birds. Mammals and birds are of two different lines, and they're only united through reptiles. And that's an important point to realize. And we have lots of different methods of diagnosing disease. Oh, not disease. Let me make a distinction. Disease is a change in structure and function. of tissue or organ. Disease is never transmitted. With infectious disease, it's the pathogen that causes the disease that gets transmitted. And some animals will develop the disease and some may not. But you hear about disease transmission and it's not correctly used most of the time. And so we use these methodologies, and now I mentioned PCR to make a diagnosis of, well, whether we have genomic material of a virus present in tissues of an animal that has died. But once you identify the presence of, whether it's a bacteria or virus or fungus, you generally have to do transmission studies. They don't always work, but to prove that there is a cause and effect relationship. That what you identified and hopefully isolated and from an animal or from a lesion, you can reproduce it. And it's not incidental. Because there are a lot of different pathogens that will grow in lesions that have nothing to do with the lesion. And so a variety of herpes viruses have been seen in reptiles. And I'll go through this quickly. The major point I want to say, which is very intriguing, is that there are more herpes viruses described in colonians, both freshwater, saltwater, and then tortoises especially. More herpes viruses than all the other reptile groups put together. For whatever, and we don't feel this is just the way things have been sampled. There's something unique about the evolution of these viruses and the evolution of these colonians. And so that we find very interesting. And this is from long ago, from the 80s. These are Chilean tortoises that came in through a major reptile importer in South Florida. Major die-off, hundreds died. Turns out these had these oral lesions. These are all necrotic areas in the oral cavity. And they have these intranuclear inclusions, very hard to see under this lighting with with this color. But within the nuclei, we call them inclusions, and they represent these viruses. Accumulations, and this is a herpes virus. And we know now today there are at least four distinct strains of herpes viruses in tortoises. And some of the herpes viruses coming in with exotic tortoises, such as the Russian tortoise, which is real problematic with herpes virus. And these viruses can jump ship. That is, they can go from one species to another. And with many herpes viruses, there may be one species where they're relatively benign and may cause some lesions, but not a high mortality. And then they get into another species, and they're very pathogenic. And you have massive die-offs. And so herpes viruses are notorious. We see that in birds, we see it in mammals, and we see it in reptiles. And this is a transmission study done long ago by one of my graduate students, Francesco Riggi, who's from Italy. And he was working on Testudo greca here as our research animal. And he was challenging them with isolates that we were able to recover from a pet Testudo and was able to duplicate the disease and show that this virus is primarily neurotropic. That is, most of the virus is in the central nervous system. And like with us, we may get herpes simplex, or like chickenpox is really herpes. And it may go into our nerves. And then some point down the road, it comes out again. And so a good part of the animal's life, it is sub or non-clinical. And then gets stressed out, and then the virus may show itself again. And we feel it works this way in these animals, somewhat to the same degree. That they get this infection, some die, some get over it, and they may be permanent carriers. And a lot of work went into this. And again, we get down to PCR. And then with this powerful tool, he was able to show latency in his investigation, and that the virus went into the central nervous system. If he didn't have PCR as a tool, he couldn't identify it because you could not see it by electron microscopy and you could not identify it any other way. And by PCR, you can identify it's in certain nerves coming off of the brain. So PCR has opened up the world to us, not only in naming different organisms and pathogens, but also for diagnostics, for testing samples for very specific agents. And these are some of the experimental animals, and you can see the plaques developing here. This is the tongue. These actually represent, right below the mucosal surface, our submandibular salivary glands. And so there's a mucosa that covers that. And that appears to be a site where at least there's viral replication and you get lesions that sort of start there and then go through the rest of the mouth. And then what he did is, this is a trigeminal nerve. I mean, he sit there and dissect these out for hours and do it aseptically, as clean as possible, and have the various branches coming off. And then he would take very small pieces of tissue and test them by PCR for this virus. And so with very small amounts of sample, you can demonstrate the presence of sequences of this virus. And basically, PCR works like a Xerox machine. You can start out with one particle or just one genomic sequence, put one paper on a Xerox machine, then you get two, and you put both on, and you get four, and you just keep doubling it, and so you're up to 1 million copies very quickly. And then he wrote up a series of papers on this, using developing an assay. This is called ELISA. This is an immunological assay. ELISAs are very commonly used as a blood testing test to determine, to measure both antibody and antigen. Antibody is what the host produces against the virus. Antigen is the virus itself. And this test can be formatted in different ways for determining the presence of both. So he developed a test that followed the animal's antibody response. And they do produce an antibody response to this virus. Generally takes 6 to 8 weeks to get high enough to measure with this test. It's very labor intensive because the antigen used in the test is the virus itself. And so you have to grow out this virus and you have to put known quantities of virus in an ELISA plate, which has 96 wells, to put the exact amount of virus in each well. And so it's very labor intensive, but it's been done. And here you get an example of him testing out various tissues, and about, you can see how many of a total 126 collected, and of those, 40 were positive, of those 126, and half, 20, were in the central nervous system. So this is very problematic for, say, trying to get a herpes-free colony of Russian tortoises. And they're a very popular animal in the pet trade. They're sold commonly through major pet dealers. And they have this problem. And that's just the reality of it. And testing for it is not inexpensive. In our lab, we do PCR for a wide variety of pathogens. PCR for DNA is about $100 for a test. And for RNA, it's a little bit more expensive because RNA is more fragile and a little bit harder to work with. And so it is expensive to go through this type of diagnostics. But if you have an animal that is worth a lot of money or a colony that is worth a lot of money, unfortunately, what I have seen over the years is that with many people, the veterinary medicine end of it and the diagnostic end of it is what everyone wants to get done for cheap. And because once you have a dead animal, it's dead and it may not have much value but you have to think of it in terms of your colony. And this is an inexpensive work. This is far cheaper than what you would pay in human medicine. And so that's an important issue that the whole reptile breeding community has to think about and realize. What are their obligations and responsibilities when they have a dead animal, especially if they have a colony? and how much money investment should one put into your collection to make sure it's healthy? And sea turtles have all kinds of problems, environmental problems of different types, especially habitat loss. This viral disease, one of the first viruses described in a reptile in the early 70s, it's called gray patch disease, seen in green turtles. It came in Turtle Farm in the Cayman Islands. Probably came in turtles from that they acquired from Suriname. More than likely it's in the wild. Came in. And then an important point is that when you take animals in from the wild and you start bringing them together into groups and increasing their density, often that becomes a triggering mechanism for infectious agents to start replicating. Because these animals are crowded, they're ideal for spreading an infectious agent from one animal to another, and at the same time, often their immune system may get compromised. And so, intense rearing of animals often is followed or accompanied by various infectious diseases. And this is another viral disease. This we isolated the virus and sequenced it eventually. And this was seen in older turtles. So we had the gray patch in turtles up to a year of age, and then this, which was called lung iron trachea disease, that occurred after they were a year of age. So we had different herpes viruses in this collection manifesting themselves at different times. And then fibropapilloma, which we started working on in about 87. I actually did some of the first work was at Cayman Turtle Farm, where they had an outbreak in the early 80s. But we had very little money, and we didn't pursue it very far. And then we got into this study with money from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and so the National Marine Fisheries Service. And we worked on a group of turtles from Florida that had these tumors. You can see them all over the animal's body, and often around their eyes. And then after looking at a lot of histological sections, I thought I would never see anything new. Then I saw this section with these ballooning changes in the epidermal cells. And then the nuclei were staining red and had an inclusion in them. And by electron microscopy, we identified a herpes virus. And this herpes virus has been, now no one has been able to isolate it. Everything that has been done with it now has been done using molecular tools. A lot of sequencing work has been done. And what we see is that there are actually several strains of this herpes virus. And so we have colonial herpes virus on the right. This is, This is the lung iron and trachea virus, and it's distinct from the others. And then we have a series of different, these are Coloniomyces, Carita from Australia and from different regions. These are from Florida. And what we find is there are several distinct types of this virus that separate out geographically. So they're not all the same. And what it shows is that these turtles are nesting in very specific areas and they don't overlap to maintain that distinctness in these viruses. And these turtles have very complicated life cycles because the loggerheads go all the way out to the Mediterranean and then back. And they may do that twice. And to maintain those distinct strains just shows you site fidelity of how these turtles are coming back to the beaches that they originated from. And then to finish with this, these are from some herpes viruses that just in the last couple of years identified in wild loggerhead sea turtles. And here's one on the penis of a turtle, and that above is a cloaca of a female. So maybe one of the first sexually transmitted diseases now. And herpes would fit in beautifully as an example of that. And And then we can go on and on and on with all types of other viruses in different groups of reptiles. The one I want to just end with now, because this takes a long time to go through, and I'll get my point home. Point home is that there are a lot of pathogens of different types, infectious agents, in reptiles. And we have screening tests for them that are expensive, but we have no immunization. And that's a major problem. And if we look back at cat shows and dog shows, pre-immunization days, before we had vaccination programs, if you wanted to get Khaleesi virus, a rhinotracheitis virus, in a kitten, well, go to a cat show prior to the days of immunization. And we have none of that, you know, with the animals we're interested in. And that's a significant problem. And so, one, buyer beware, and two, you can never quarantine long enough. The further you can quarantine an animal, the longer you can quarantine it, the animal can, does well, eats and grows and acts well. Never introduce an ill animal into your collection, into your main collection. Never, 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 never. And people will often they'll get an animal for breeding, and they need it for a specific time, and they'll just shrug off quarantine at that time. And that's a problem. That's a real problem. If I can go to the second or no PowerPoint. Yes, I just want to go to this disease now called inclusion body disease, which has been very intriguing. Ed and I have been working on it for a long time. And there are two. There's a postdoc at another school and a PhD student working under me, both working on this. And there was emerging infectious disease too. I think there were three items on that flat. Oh, did I take? Or do you have it? You saved it. It should be emerging too. And we're going. This is paramyxovirus, which is a problematic viral infection in snakes, in a wide range of snakes. And we've worked on this a very long time. And other people overseas have worked on it. Lots of different strains of this virus that fall into different groups. And it can be pretty devastating in collections. This is an RNA virus. It affects the respiratory tract, but it also can affect and cause lesions in other tissues. And this virus probably has been shipped around the world as people, especially in Germany, where it's been seen quite a bit. People sending animals from here to Germany and Germany to here have probably moved around these viruses with those animals. And so today, pathogens can be spread around the world rather quickly. And we don't have any good control over that. And let's see, I want to get to the end. I'm going to flash through a bunch of these. These are all, because I want to get to IBD and not pick up. Okay. Inclusion body disease of boa snakes. This has been a very intriguing disease that was first recognized, probably been around longer, but first recognized in the late 70s. And it could be, and infected animals could either be subclinical or non-clinical, I mean, showing nothing, but still having the inclusions of what we use to make a diagnosis of this disease. And these, it's only recently what we now have an idea what these inclusions consist of. And so the name inclusion body disease comes from these characteristic inclusions that may be found in one or more tissues in the animal's body. Sometimes they're only seen in the brain and in only very specific parts of the brain. Other times, in other cases, you will see it in almost every tissue, including the skin. And I've had animals sent to me as controls that were supposed to be normal that turned out to be loaded with inclusions. So not all snakes that have these inclusions show clinical signs of illness. But those that do, it may be central nervous system disease, where their head tilts, or you turn them on their back and they can't right themselves, locomotor problems, or paresis, where they can't even move at all. Regurgitation, stomatitis, pneumonia, enteritis, lymphoma. We've had several with like leukemia and other neoplastic diseases, and round cell tumors. And here's some examples of what they do. Dystotinus is twisting or stargazing, and put them on their back. They can't right themselves. In the esophagus, these snakes, these boas have, boas pythons, have what are called esophageal tonsils. They're very well developed. They're somewhat ellipsoid. They have a cleft in them. We wrote a paper on their presence back in the early 80s. It was just a new structure that hadn't been, well, an old structure that never was described before. And so here they are up here. The arrows are pointing to them. And they line the esophagus, particularly the esophagus caudal to the heart. And then here's a ill boa with, you can see these abscesses in these tonsils, and they're abscessed. And then these are the inclusions. The arrows are pointing to these red, we call them eosinophilic, because they're picking up this eosin stain that we use. And so this is liver, and this is pancreas. And so we have these very large inclusions scattered about. And in the pancreas, many, many cells have these inclusions. So this is the hallmark of this disease. When a pathologist recognized these inclusions, they would generally categorize it as inclusion body disease. And this is in neurons in the brain. This neuron has two at either pole. And here are others. Here's a nice round one that may have slipped out of the cell, but or surrounded by a cell membrane, just can't make it out. And you can see them in the blood. Now, this is a Reichiemse stain, a different kind of stain, so they look blue. And this is in the lymphocyte. And here's another very round one. And if we use H&E stain, they stain red. And this is what these inclusions look like in tissue by electron microscopy. They start forming. They're released as these very small round units. And they have a very strong properties of polymerization. And they come together, and then they stick, and they add on, and they build up. And this is one of this is a figure from Ed Wozniak, published this paper back in, I think it's 2001?
2000.
And he was able to demonstrate, he was able to demonstrate a, I'll get it. I know, my thumb is flying, keeps flying over. A unique protein that was present in these inclusions, which is called the inclusion body protein. And it was a certain weight, 68 kilodaltons, and it was separated out. And so that study went on for a number of years without further work. And then about 3.5 years ago, a graduate student of mine started working on a PhD focusing on this protein, and Ed has been on as an advisor to her. And then just about 3 years ago, there's a group from the University of California, San Francisco, they're Howard Hughes Medical Institute. There is a postdoc there that became interested in this, and independent of us, started working on it. Their work was trying to identify the genome of the infectious agent, and they believe to be a virus. And they were working from the viral end of it towards the protein, and my graduate student was working from the protein the other way, towards the virus. And they sort of met in the middle in terms of their findings. And so this protein, pretty much the student reproduced identifying and isolating this protein and working with it for 3.5 years using different kinds of gels. And And then at the same time, working with a retrovirus that we had isolated from snakes with this disease. And now we don't currently believe that this retrovirus has anything to do with it. And other papers have been published. Other viruses have been found with snakes with this disease. And what I want to do is leave it with that and say that I haven't updated it. The most recent findings is that the group from the University of California, San Francisco, has identified several viruses which are related to the arenavirus. And we may speak about that because I think that's one of the items to discuss up here. But the arenaviruses are in the family Arenaviridae. They're an RNA virus. And they've primarily been seen in rodents. And the snakes appear to have these this virus, which is in different groups. They're not all exactly the same. They're related. And there may be one or more, two or more of these in different boas and the pythons they haven't worked on, but at least in boas. And so from their work, they were able to sequence the viral genome and then come up with the amino acid sequence for this protein in the inclusion. My graduate student is taking 3.5 years of doing isolations of the protein and purifying it and finally got it sequenced. And the sequencing, their predicted sequence and her direct sequencing match. So we know these inclusions are made up of this protein that go along with this nucleic acid sequence from these arenaviruses. So this is a very interesting time of this work coming together like that. And then the next step, of course, will be to do transmission studies to show that they can duplicate the disease. They've isolated a virus. They don't know right now if it's the same virus that they're seeing in tissue or that they've sequenced. But they've isolated a virus, they're working with it, and eventually we'll do transmission studies. So this is another example of, you know, this dedication. There's a certain amount of money behind this. Our project was funded by the Morris Animal Foundation. Often there's very little money to do this work, especially with lizards and snakes. And so you do it on a shoestring. And so it's taken all these years to get to this point in time. But now I think we're closer. And if these viruses can be nailed down, then diagnostic tests can be developed, molecular tests, to be able to screen animals, to find who is carrying this virus and who is not. Because we definitely do have some animals sent to us as negatives that we have not been able to show that the virus is in their tissues. So we believe there are negatives out there, definitely, that hopefully one day bringing those together, getting a founder stock, and then having a clean stock. Otherwise, this virus is everywhere out there in the community of boas and certain pythons. Thank you.